Welcome, everyone, back to the Why I Don't Like podcast. I'm your host, Christian Ashley, here to entertain you as I sit down and record episodes on the media that I consume, and yet I don't like. Now, you're all saying, what? You're back. Yes, I am back. It has been over a year since I last recorded. You've had some other things in your feed if you're listening to this on your podcast form. There have been plenty of other things I've been on for Systematic Ecology and Let Nothing Move You and the like. But I have neglected, this is the other way to put it, I've neglected Why I Don't Like. There's many reasons for that. One was a huge one was time. Back then, I was in my last semester of seminary and getting everything done. I graduated, so guess what? Your boy has mastered divinity itself. Claps for me. What I haven't mastered yet is finding a job. So surprise, surprise. So that has been another huge factor there, is that while I've had a lot of free time, most of my time has been going towards interviewing with churches and stuff like that to, you know, get a pastoral job somewhere, whether head, associate, youth, somewhere in that regard. I'm not going to say I have bupkis to show for it, because there have been, you know, some ways inside to make connections and meet new people and learn where I definitely don't want to end up going to church and serving at. So it has been a complete failure. But at the same time, I still don't have a job in that field. So that has been taking a lot of my time. And to be perfectly honest, I kind of fell out of love in this for a bit. And it was the new hotness for a while. I really enjoyed doing it. And yet things kept getting in the way. And I said, well, if I'm not going to take this seriously, I'm not going to do it. I would have loved to have given you guys like updates along the way, but it just didn't happen, obviously, since this has been over a year since the last episode released. So what does that mean? It means we're back. What way, shape, or form, I couldn't 100% tell you, like, yes, this is going to be weekly from here on out, or bi-weekly, or bi-monthly, or whatever. It's going to be like it kind of always was. It's just going to release when I feel like doing it. And I know it's going to bum some people out. You know, sometimes it'll look like I'm being very consistent. Other times it's not. It's just part of the lifestyle right now. It's going on. I'm not happy with it, but it's where I'm at. I'm very grateful for the circumstances that I am in, you know, that I do have a loving family around me right now, helping me out. I have a great group of friends who've been looking out for me and praying for me and watching over me. So, and they just got to the point where I wanted to do this again. And I know there's been announcements, you know, the third season of Mushoku Tensei is coming out fairly soon. There was also kind of that point of, oh, do I time it for that? It's like, no, I'll just do it when I do it. And when that does release, I'll do that when I do it. So yeah, there I am. So if this is your first episode, you're going, okay, you've wasted my time, Christian. Sorry. Here we are. Explain what the show is. I guess every episode is everyone's first episode. Like, this is a show where I discuss the things where I'm not that hot on, that I don't like. These are not necessarily things that I hate, even though they do contain things more than likely that I do hate, which is a reason why I wouldn't like something. My goal on the show is not to say, hey, if you like this thing, you're an idiot. You have no idea what media literacy is, and you should feel wrong and like just end yourself. Like, no, never. 100% never have the feelings you feel for a show. I've had, along the way, there have been a lot of fans of Mushoku Tensei who have defended it in the comments and the other videos that I've done on this. And I want to thank them for the work they put in, because they've been very reasonable. I've not had, except for one comment that was forever ago, just someone who was just like, oh, your opinion is trash because you don't understand what's going on, because you can't understand a complexity that is Mushoku Tensei. Now, this is a complex show. And I'm saying it as someone who does not like it, which is why it's on the show. So I will give reasons for why I don't like it. I hope that will make sense to everyone listening. It's like, what my personal little bugaboos I'm not very big on. I mean, Rudeus himself is a big one. As you may notice, if you're on YouTube, then you can see I do have something down there for, you know, if Rudeus has no haters left, then I am dead. You know what? Because that would be true. And I say that as someone who hates Rudeus, not because there's nothing redeeming in him. I say that as someone who wishes that those redeeming instances were more frequent than they end up showing up. And there are some redeeming instances in the episodes we're going to be covering today, because we're going to be finishing up the first season of Mushoku Tensei today. This is going to be the first season, part two, episodes 21 through 23. So also as well, if you're new here, I want to remind old listeners as well, there are no edits to this show. Whatever I end up, you know, putting up here when I'm live streaming it, that's what get put, that blah, 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 like this flub line, a perfect example, that gets thrown into the show. That I don't have an editor for this. I don't know how to edit. no one's reached out to say they'd be willing to do it. And you know what? They don't have to. We're just going to keep doing it. We'll do it live. So if that's something that offends you, something you're not big on, go in peace. But I do also like to show, so not everything comes off across as negative, but something that I do like, even though this one's going to be a mixed bag and it'll make sense when I get there. What I do like a lot, and I'm fairly certain I haven't talked about this one before, is Darker Than Black, the first season only. Now, if you've never watched this show, probably because there were awful times when it was very hard to get a DVD release of this. Like, I was on a waiting list for years and it just never came up. And the next time it showed up, it was like $200 some. And it's like, I could barely afford it when it was 60. It's like, I get it. You know, this is the reason why people, not that I would ever say someone should do this, and not that I would ever do this myself. There's a reason some people pirate stuff, and that's because you don't make it accessible or reasonable. And while that is a bummer, if you can get access to Darker Than Black, however you choose to do so, you are in for an absolute treat in the first season. Because this does superpowers, right? It's a very complex world of, you know, some black and gray morality without everything just feeling like a total and complete bummer. Like, oh, we're all grimdark and everything, every person's bad, all humans are evil, all that grimdark nonsense. Now, there's some of that in there, but it's not like the totality. It's not like the ending thesis of the show. And now I stress season one because season two was made without really much of a plan and it kind of sucks. And it is really kind of part of my unholy trilogy of like sequels or later seasons of other stuff. You got Darker Than Black season two, Elreka 7, Astral Ocean, Blood Sea. I'm sure there's some others I could add to the list, but it wouldn't be an unholy trinity anymore. It's just bad. But you know what's great? Season one. If you want to have, well, it's about 26 some episodes, really super fun. Check it out. So, another thing I'll be adding here before we actually get into the show proper is I am no longer going to be putting images, you know, inside of, you know, the video proper. It's not the most time consuming thing in the world, but it does stall things immensely when I'm in the middle of an episode trying to get the perfect screen cap for something. I have to wait for things to be perfectly right. And it's not really my thing. So, you know what I said? These things take long enough to write notes and make sure I get everything right and make sure I do the proper research. So one less thing to do would make my life a whole lot easier. So if that's something you're not big at either, once again, go in peace. I know that's cooler. It's better if you have like images on YouTube and there's better people out there who can do such things. That is not me. I'm just going to be honest with you. I'm just an idiot who can talk about things and hopefully back things up to where you say, okay, even if I don't agree with him, I can see where he's coming from. So all that preamble out of the way, we have three episodes to discuss as we wrap up the first season. And let's just go and get into it, starting with episode 21, Turning Point 2. And you know what that means? Things are going to change. And that is one thing I do immensely appreciate about this series is, yeah, this is an anime part because I've not read, you know, the web novel. It's just a web novel originally. Then there was a manga, or there is a manga. I forget. It's been a while. I'm out of practice. I'll put it that way. So I am an anime only in that regard. Yeah, there are some future events I do know about. But when you see that turning point, you know, like it is literally a turning point in the series. And here we are in this episode. So let's go into it. So we start in Media Res, where we see Rudeus and Ruzhird and Eris have been attacked and defeated by an at the time unknown figure. Obviously, the rest of the episode gets us that way. And in the midst of this, Rudeus is kind of reminiscing on his life. And it's kind of a theme of these final three episodes of the first season here is Rudeus looking back on his life. Now, if only he actually learned a lot from it, but that's its own thing. And he talked about all the unexpected things that have happened to him and his friends and how sometimes people just suddenly die. We didn't go back into the past to show them traveling through some snowy mountains and some very rugged terrain. They're having to be very careful about their movements. You know, as they stay at a place for the night, they all hear the sounds of a dragon's roar. Eris goes out to investigate it and sees a dragon flying over them. And then suddenly there are multiple red dragons. She says that she'd like to hunt one day. So, as always, I typically like to start for commentation, other than the other stuff I did before, many comments, with the opening scene. And this is a very solid opening scene. Because, yeah, a huge part of this side of things has been to travel, and that could easily get boring, but you're seeing new locales, seeing new fantastical creatures and stuff like that. So it doesn't really get boring as it could be in another lesser show. This isn't like, what was it, Lost Continent, MST3K with the mountain climbing for 20 straight minutes. This isn't that. There's some, once again, beautiful scenery is shown here. Like, you, this anime, unlike a certain recent season of One Punch Man, I know the low bar for a joke there, actually cares about what it's trying to develop and show to you. And it's beautiful. I mean, there's no other way to say it. It is a very beautiful scene of the various places they go through. So I'm up in there with that. And we get the dragons. Like, we've known they've existed in the world, but to actually, like, see one on screen. And, like, we get the little hints of what that could mean for, like, the mythology of the world, for the bestiaries of the world. And, of course, Eris being Eris. And, like, hey, oh, something big. I'm going to go fight it. That's my girl. So, yeah. But then we go before that, and I should have started there, so sorry. But we get the in media res moment of Rudia seemingly dying. And it's captivating. And as someone who really likes the thought of Rudia dying, I'm like, oh, no, wow, how did this happen? Like, I'm getting what I want. But how did that happen? How did it occur? And really, you find out it's through no fault of his own, other than he couldn't shut open his mouth. Like, for once, it wasn't Rudius being himself, but it is him being himself, and that he's asking questions, but it's not in a typical Rudius way of he had to ruin it by being himself. So that's a very effective opening. We've got this mysterious figure, like, what's going on here? Like, Ruzhard's down, Eris is down, Rudius is dying. Like, how is this possible? Because we've seen what they're all capable of, and in a very competent writing moment here. So I will give it its accolades before we get into other things that happen in this one and later episodes. So going back into the episode proper, we see that Eris and Ruzhard are practicing with one another. Rudius is watching them. Ruzhard wins again. But unlike other times they fought, he tells Eris that she should consider herself to be a warrior because she's grown up. And it doesn't matter, because she kind of protests, like, what are you talking about? I haven't even beat you. It's like, well, it doesn't matter. You've never beaten me, because you've got the heart of a warrior. And coming from someone like Ruzhard, that means a lot. And she takes it for what that is. She's stunned. And she asks Rudius to pinch her because she can't believe that she's awake. And he asks her, she's not going to hit him if he does pinch her. And she says, no, she won't. So he Rudiuses up the situation, verbing himself as per normal, by pinching, I think, her breast. It's kind of odd. It wasn't really, I don't know whether it was animator's call, director's call, something like that. You could tell it's probably that area. Maybe I'm just an idiot. I completely missed an obvious clue of what it would have been. And it's just, regardless of the fact, it's a place that he shouldn't be pinching her in. Let's put it that way. And that, of course, makes her righteously angry, and she slugs him. And he even gets off of that, too, because he has to ruin everything. Rudius ruins everything. Nothing has changed. It's been over a year, and I still think about that. Rudius ruins everything. So they travel a little bit more, again, through some more rugged terrain, very cold, wintry setting here. They see some more dragons, and Eris, true to who she is, wants to go and fight them, and Ruzhard's like, okay, you've had your moment. You shouldn't be thinking that way. She's like, well, why? And Rudius explains, you know, the academic side of things, which he's very good at doing, that, you know, they travel in packs. So the three of them, even together, wouldn't be that much of a match against them. And then Ruzhard, like, kills the buzz a little even more in the right way, saying, hey, even a lesser member of the seven great powers would be forced back from attacking them. They could kill them individually, but not in a pack. And he goes in to talk about how, you know, the technique god is, you know, number one, the dragon god is the second strongest. And it's at this moment they happen upon the man from the beginning, and the two warriors freeze at his power, just like there's this inherent fear and trembling in his presence. And Rudius simply looks ahead, unaffected by this. Like, he sees them react, and he's like, well, what's going on with them? But he looks at this man. He's accompanied by a girl wearing a mask. And these two strangers then walk past our group. Rudius stares at them, and the man stops, which kind of surprises the girls he's with. And Ruzhard advises the kids to not move a muscle because he knows they're in significant danger. And I think I think it was a cow horse kind of thing that they were using to carry their packs, to completely freaks out and willingly jumps off the ledge to its death, like just showing like the presence this figure has. He then name drops both Ruchard and Eris, which freaks them out. Rudeus's eyes starts freaking out, like, you know, kind of seeing the future for a little bit, and he's seeing these different possibilities and it's messing with them. But he himself is not recognized by the man. And the man then tries to leave, you know, saying, oh, they're not important. Like, he knows who they are, but, like, they have nothing to do with his mission or anything. But then the girl asks, are you sure? What if you're not right? And Rudeus then stops to both of them by asking, he asks them the weight, and he introduces himself and asks the man his name, and he says that his name is Orsted. And Rudeus asks if he knows Eris and Ruchard, but he says he hasn't met them yet, which should be very clear indication, even without knowledge of what happens later on. Oh, this guy has experienced the future in some way, shape, or form. And Rudeus doesn't need to understand that. And he asks which Grey Rat clan that Rudeus has come from, because he gave his full name. And he says that he's the son of Paul. And he's like, no, you're not. Paul only has two daughters, which is a huge sign of later events as well, which is, so I will save this for this episode. Excellent foreshadowing for a lot of this. He then approaches them and says, you know, he knows that look in Rudeus's eye, and Rudeus asks him, hey, just kind of an out of blue, like, okay, maybe you're a little stronger. So maybe you know something about this. You know anything about the Mana disaster, Mana cataclysm? And the man says, Orsted says he doesn't. So he apologizes, Rudeus does, for wasting Orsted's time, and goes to leave, until Orsted kind of has this moment of eureka and says, hey, does the word man god mean anything to Rudeus? Which makes Rudeus tell him that, yeah, he appears in my dreams. So the moment he says that, Orsted attacks. And Ruchard barely gets in the way to protect him. Like, you can see that Ruchard's skills are amazing, but he is completely and utterly outclassed by Orsted. Orsted himself believes that Rudeus is an apostle of the man god, which kind of sort of true, but he doesn't know the full story. And he goes to kill him, and he defeats Ruchard with, I think it's like just like two punches with ease, which says a lot about him. And he then goes to like finalize his kill with Rudeus. That's when Eris intervenes, and she's beaten with one punch, thrown into a wall, essentially. Starts not like bleeding out, but bleeding profusely. And yeah, and Orsted even compliments her, says, you've improved, but you lack polish, which also says a lot about the circumstances of how he could know her, which is for other matters down the road. Rudeus continually kind of sees his death through his future sight, but instead, Orsted just brutalizes him with one attack, knocks him out, not completely, but knocks him to the ground, and tells him to tell the man god that Orsted is coming for him. Eris attempts a magic spell, but it fails due to her wounds, which kind of surprises him. It's like almost like he's never seen her use a fireball kind of magic before. A hint to later events, perhaps, one could say. And Rudeus gets back up, and he uses some incantationless magic to attack Orsted. And Orsted kind of, oh, that's kind of interesting, but he overwhelms him. Rudeus then crafts a much larger spell than normal and sends it toward Orsted, who protects himself with a magical shield, kind of nullifies the effects of Rudeus's magic, and he wonders at Rudeus's potential, saying he might be on par with Laplace, who in the backstory was like the big guy back in the day, if you remember that. I had to remember that too. So at this point, Orsted kind of picks him up as, hey, why aren't you using that incantationless magic to like repair your wounds? Says, nah, ultimately it doesn't matter. And tells Rudeus, you're going to die, and cuts through his body, like, with his hand, goes full donut, and drops him down, and walks away. Eris cries out Rudeus's name. Rudeus thinks he's going to die, begging, like, for two more years so he can keep his promise with Eris, because there's that about two-year gap between the two of them. And Orsted tells Nanahoshi, who he names the girl, that they're going to leave, but she says that there's something bothering her about Rudeus, and then Rudeus fades to black. And we'll stop there as far as summary goes. I have to say it. Rudeus being Rudeus. This is a huge moment for Eris and her character, and that she has been fighting extremely hard to be recognized by Ruchard, you know, on the cusp of adulthood, being her own woman, being a fighter, being a warrior. And he does so finally after all the time they spent together, and about the time that he's starting to consider leaving them behind, you know, because he agreed to take them the way they needed to go, and that was it. And what has to happen? Rudeus has to happen. Can you imagine someone you're interested in, and they've got this huge thing, this, he got a promotion, or their boss compliments them, and you're like, oh man, can you pinch me? Is this real? And you go and grope them? What the hell? Who the hell do you think you are? Think you can do this? Like, oh my gosh, he's so frustrating. Because there's moments here, and there's always moments of like potential for Rudeus, which is what I hate about him. I want to like him. And there are moments where I'm almost there, and then I'm reminded of who he truly is as a person. Because, like, hey, he's noticed something weird is going on here. Well, if you don't understand, ask questions. And he doesn't know that this could bite him in the butt. So I'm just going to throw that against him. Like, this is probably what I would have done. It's like, hey, what's going on here? And interrogates, like, something's, my friends are all messed up around you. Like, what's your deal? Who are you? Let me introduce myself so we can reach some common ground there in some way, shape, or form. But that same person's the same person who does what he does to Eris. And I hate it. I hate it. Because, once again, it's like there's two different people we're dealing with here. There's the ultra pervert idiot who will use any excuse in the world to take advantage of another, of a woman. But then there's also this really wonderfully erudite, rational person who you want to like. And yeah, I know that's all across fiction in many regards. I mean, even history, you've got people like Lord Byron who, you know, did increasingly terribly sexual things to a lot of people, some of whom were very young, but also was a tremendous writer and poet and thinker. So I know a single person can have these two things. I'm not saying that that's impossible, because we contain multitudes. And unfortunately, this is his example of multitude. But it's annoying. Because, yeah, he gets punched. Yeah, he gets the perfect revenge mode moment. But, like, does he learn anything from it? No. And in fact, you're in what happens later on in these episodes, that makes it worse. And we'll get there when we get there. So that's it. So moving on from there to Orsted's introduction. This is how you introduce someone. Like, my hat off to the man writing the series, who I don't know if we've actually gotten his real name. He's always gone by a pen name, if I understand correctly. But you got it. Down pat. Orsted's introduction. This is how you could potentially give a new villain to the series, or just introduce a character. Like, there's obviously something more to Orsted than just him being a plain out-and-out villain because of how he treats them and everything. It's only when he learns certain information that he gets really hostile. But there's also this whole thing of, like, what is it about him, like, everyone else being afraid of him? Like, animals are running in fear. Like, we'll get that in the rest of the episode, the explanation for why. But, like, this here right now, why can't things be like this more often? Because there's a menace brought into the series here. Like, we've heard about, you know, the seven, you know, different gods and stuff like that, and like the seven swords, all that stuff. And we get to see one, not knowing the totality of who they are. We'll get more information in a bit. But we get to see one in action, and it means a lot because our heroes are hopelessly outclassed. And this could easily be one of those moments of you create the invincible villain or invincible side character. You know, they could just solve everything. You know, if they had actually gotten their butts off of, you know, their throne or whatever. And this isn't that. Because we learn along the way why that's not true. But like in this moment in time, you were wondering, who is this man? How is he able to do what he does? And oh my gosh, is everyone going to live? And it's astonishing. Like I said, my hat off to the author, because this is done really well. And I want to praise when you do well. I want to curse when you do terribly. This, I give you my praise, because I really enjoy Orsted coming into the story and in showcasing a little bit of who he is without like revealing everything about himself. He doesn't give like a 5-minute monologue about his backstory or anything like that. Like, you get enough to know, I am compelled by this person. I want to learn more about them, but I am also terrified of this person. And we also get a little more here. Like, speaking of foreshadowing, the whole stuff with Nana Hoshi here on a repeated viewing, wonderfully done. Because when events are brought out about, you know, the nature of Orsted and why people run away from him, and you go, okay, that's what they did, so why isn't she? And you go, oh! And not to spoil that for anyone else, but if you're, for some reason, following along with these episodes with me, and you waited an entire year to do so, which I'm very sorry about my schedule slip there. But if that's somehow the case, oh my gosh, I don't want to take it away from you, because, like, once again, repeated viewing, that makes a lot more sense to me. And I appreciate when I can go into a media, even one I'm not typically very fond of or like in this instance, and go, I see what you did there. Let me give you your laurels for that moment. So let's move on into the summary proper again. So Rudeus wakes up in his old body in the man god's realm. He welcomes him, tells him, oh, it was a shame about what happened there. He then tells Rudeus that Orsted is the wicked dragon god. And Rudeus kind of has some doubts about that, naturally. So, given who he's dealing with, he questions him about how he couldn't have warned him about Orsted, which is an excellent question. The man god then tells Rudeus he simply can't see Orsted like he can others, so he had no idea they would bump into each other. So, because Orsted has a curse on him, as he is one of the cursed children of the world, we get some more lore here, that makes detection nigh impossible on him. Orsted also has three other curses, in addition to this one of which is that he's hated and feared by everyone, which is something, in a rare moment of almost empathy, Rudeus kind of identifies with. But then he questions why he didn't do the same, logically so, as both Ruzhard and Eris were affected by it, and you know, the animal was, but he wasn't. And a man guy kind of speculates whether or not he actually knows the answer. It's up in the air. I'm pretty sure he does. And he says it's possibly because Rudeus is from another world, so the curse doesn't affect him in the same way, even though he has a body that was from this reality. I can see the logic behind it. Rudeus asks, you know, okay, well, if Orsted is a cursed child, is Ruzhard one too? And man god tells him, no, he's not cursed by that, but instead by the spears, because one of the things that Laplace did back in the day is transferred like his fear, the fear of the people's fears, something like that, into the spear itself that Ruzhard wields. And that kind of, by proxy, made him and the other super kind of looked down upon by other people. And Rudeus then questions, you know, if the man god knew nothing would be changed by trying to help Ruzhard's image, why would he do what he did? But he counters it by saying that the curse of Superior is almost gone by now, with only just a little left on him, but on Ruzhard, but not as much since he shaved his head, which had the same color as Laplace's hair. And I had completely forgotten about this information when I was rewatching this, and I was like, oh, okay, that's kind of interesting. So the things that Rudeus did to, you know, kind of encourage other people to look to the Superd and Ruzhard more actually helped out in the long end, and the curse is kind of dying, it's fading. And the reason it did is because he met Rudeus, which, hey, somehow, somewhere out there is saying thank God for Rudeus, which means that it wasn't for nothing. And that's something that he's grateful for. Now, the man god claims that Orsted is the strongest there is. You know, even if technically the technique god is number one, because if they ever actually truly fought one another, he'd win. And he claims that, you know, his full power could destroy the world, but the curses that that Orsted has on him prevent that. So presumably one of the other two curses remaining has something to do with that. Rudeus then realizes that the man god knows a lot about someone he can't check in on, which flusters him. But then Rudeus pansies out instead of like drilling in for more information, which is what a rational person would have done there. He says, oh, well, I guess all the work that you did in restoring, you know, Ruzhard's reputation and saving my sister's makeup for that. It's like, no, bad, bad Rudeus. Keep interrogating. you may not have gotten the answers you wanted, but you had him on a run here. He was giving up information for free. Keep up the ruse, man. You know, you're older than you look. Keep up the ruse. Let this idiot keep talking. But whatever. We can't reveal those story information beats right now because our protagonist is an idiot. And part of this, he's not a complete idiot because he also thinks that he's going to die. He's never going to see him again because he's dying. He considers it very lucky that he even got a second life at all. He tells the man God goodbye, but man God reveals you're actually dead. And Rudeus wakes up. Eris is tending to him, but the wound in his chest, his donut, is gone. And Eris says that Nanahoshi got Orsted to save Rudeus's life, and they are all alive. You know, Rudeus is still knocked out, but they're alive. Now, he hugs Eris. She kind of playfully punches him on the head, but like she's obviously upset, cries over everything, afraid that she had lost him. He apologizes for making her worry, but she's glad he's alive, and that is how we end episode 21. So let's talk about Rudeus and Rudeus's growth. And I mean that in a positive way. Yeah, there are still some gripes about how he handled the whole man-god situation, but he shows some moments of brilliance here of utilizing the man-god's kind of little willy-nilly nature to like get information that he needs. And if only he'd pressed the attack, we could have known more. But still, it shows that he's just not a sucker completely when it comes to an enigmatic trickster figure like the man god. And I say this to someone, yeah, I know some events that happen later on, but like I've never been like, oh yeah, he's on the up and up, this man god. He's a good guy. He's one of the good guys. I don't think necessarily would by that means mean he's a bad guy, but there's something up. If I were in a scenario, it's like, okay, there's something about you that makes me question things. So let me see what I can get out of you. And Rudeus does that to his credit. He also, I mean, when it comes to dying, shows some maturity. And the fact that, hey, he lived a very terrible life in, you know, Japan. He got the second chance at life. He got a brand new family, a new chance to explore. He got to cast magic, meet wonderful people, make friends with other races, and travel the world that he never got to do in his old life. And it was almost like this moment of, okay, if I die now, it's fine. And you know what? The Rudeus of episode 1 would not say what the Rudeus of episode 21 is saying right now. And that is good. That is a sign of growth. Now, if only he could do it in other areas. Because this is a pivotal moment in the story. So it does force him to think. And it forces him, like, going back, okay, what could I have done differently? That nothing. We were toast. The only reason I'm alive is because for some reason this Nanahoshi person wanted me to be kept alive. And we'll learn why later on. Not anytime soon, but later on. And it's kind of fun to see him in this way because I hate to say it gives me hope because I know what happens later on. But like there's that moment of like you can almost believe this is the start of something where he could be better than who I think him to be. And let me get this straight. I don't want to think of him as a terrible character, even though he is. I want him to be better. And that's what kind of is very frustrating to me about him. Be better. You have the potential. And yet we keep going back to the well of these stupid things. And you keep like pulling out the rug underneath me and I fall down face first and go, how could this keep happening? Am I an idiot? And the answer is yes. But there's still some good here. And that's why I do rate this episode as highly as I do. We'll get to that later on because this is a good one. In a bad series, this is a good episode. Now to talk about one of the worst episodes, let's go to the next one, even though it starts off pretty well. Episode 22, Dreams and Reality. Rudeus has a dream where he's kind of back at Greymount Manor with everyone. Like, his friends and family are there in a way they never got to do. Like, he sees Sylphie and Roxy there, too. We get some images of wine dropping, seemingly at the start in the place of blood. We'll get what that kind of means later on. and the imagery used there, you know, he sees like all three of his little love interests and emphasis on the little, finally hears the wine dropping, sees his old body, and cries out for everyone to stay with him until he realizes that he's being killed by Orsted in the dream, not actual. So he wakes up scared and upset, and Ruzhurd is there by a fire. He's been on watch and asks him, you know, are you okay? Rhea says that he is. And Ruzhurd very bluntly, to his credit, a great man, asks him who the man god is. Love him. Wish he were in a better series. Rudius then explains it all, once again, to his credit, to an extent, because I'm pretty sure he doesn't bring up the reincarnation because he doesn't do that with anyone outside of one other person later on in the series. And that's only, it's his own thing. So he explains it all. And Rudius comments, it's kind of hard to believe that, you know, the seven gods of ancient times are still around. But, you know, Rudius is telling him and he believes it, so he believes it. Rudius, you know, then brings up explaining how the man god talked about how the Superd got cursed. And this kind of makes Ruzhurd smirk in a knowing fashion, like, oh, of course, it's something like this. And he tells Rudius, oh, you've been wasting time on my behalf. We're just cursed. We're always going to be cursed. That's when Rudius then further explains about how that all has been changed. And even Ruzhurd's name can be cleansed over time. And Ruzhurd, like, kind of like turns his back to him, like the very proud kind of way of, I want to show you that I'm upset, like in a good way. And that's where that kind of ends for a moment. We didn't watch the next day as the group are traveling again. Rudius is trying to use magic to try and replicate the spell that Orsted used. You know, Eris is kind of quizzing him on his intentions. They're both kind of on horseback together. And Rudius says that it was magic that kind of nullified magic. So he's researching it for his own ends. And he'd like to escape Orsted if they ever find him again, which is smart. Smart play. Love it. Eris then clings tighter to him in response while they're on horseback. Opening scene. Now, I've made it very apparent that I love Ruzhurd and I love Eris. For very different reasons. Even though some of the things that happen later on, I'm not too fond of, including in this very episode for one of their number. But the scene with Ruzhurd being told the truth about the curse and that how everything they had done mattered, and him like being like upset in a good way, that was well done. And I'm going to be a huge downer because it's all downhill from here, but the episode has a fine enough start, one that goes, it gave me false hope. Because this is good. Ruzhurd has lived for how long? And he'll explain later on, like, everything that he's done. And yet, in the course of knowing Rudius and Eris, that curse he thought could never be beaten, it's starting to fade away. And we'll see some later moments in, you know, these two episodes of that beginning to take place. And it's wonderful. This man who has carried on this burden for hundreds of years, lost children, never really had friends again. And now, oh, things are changing. Because of my relationship with these two kids, they're becoming adults in this world. If I remember correctly, 15 is when you're an adult in this world, which is why it's important for Eris later on. And of course, Eris, like, this is, in many ways, her episode and parts of the next episode. We'll get there when we get there. Let's just go back into the summary. So they end up at Rudius's old family home, find it completely broken. Rudius kind of relives past memories of, you know, his growth, his family, sees, you know, Roxy and Sylphie there. But everything else has been lost too. The town is gone, destroyed by the Mana Cataclysm. Rudius tells him, like, look, I got you to your home. This is what we agreed on. You don't need a babysitter anymore. And tells them that he's in Rudius's debt. And Rudius denies this. It's like, no, yeah, Ruzhurd was one protecting them. But Ruzhurd counters by saying that Rudius taught him to look at the world in a new way. And he proudly displays the figurine of Dead End that Rudius made and talks about everything they did together. saying he hadn't done a thing to overturn the people's perception of himself or the superior in 400 years, but Rudius did it in a short amount of time. Rudius then tries to deflect and say, oh, the man guy's responsible for that. But Rudius said, I don't care about some guy I've never seen. I care about you, Rudius, who actually helped him. Rudius then tells Eris that she has talent that could one day even surpass him. And she agrees, even though she's fighting back tears. And he then asks them, hey, can I treat you like children one last time? And he pats their heads. You know, Eris starts to cry. He returns Rudius's necklace to him, but Rudius refuses, saying he wants you to have it. Rudius leaves, telling them he'll see them again as he reflects on their time together. Rudius bows to him. Rudius leaves. He and Eris then travel to Gander together to find her family. And they end up at a refugee camp outside of the remnants of the capital and find, you know, Ghislaine there. And Eris hugs her. So they're both relieved to see that they're both alive. You know, her old butler, Alphonse, is there. I think it was their butler, right? It's been a while. And he asks that Rudius stay outside, but, you know, Eris refuses because, you know, she wants him to explain what happened while they were gone. She wants Rudius to hear it too. And he tells her, unfortunately, that both of her parents died. They got teleported into disputed territory when the Mana Cataclysm happened. Her grandfather was, you know, murdered by the state due to people needing someone to blame for what had happened. The whole Ashura kingdom is in shambles, and I believe it's pronounced Pylaemon, her cousin, if she were to be found alive, he would wish to take her as a concubine, which all this information one by one, but he's had plenty of time to think about this. You know, there's also a secret part that Eris has kind of thought about this too over time. Ghislaine, hearing this, is like very upset. She asks Eris to run away, but Eris tells everyone to shut up and she needs some time alone, even Rudius. So he leaves and he just hears her crying, you know, at the state of things. And Rudius sees, you know, the sign of people missing. Some names are being erased. Either they've been found dead or they've been found alive. And he talks with Ghislaine and sees that his mother hasn't been found, but Sylphie's name isn't on there either. But neither name is listed among the dead. So that does give him some hope. So a lot to cover here. First off, the ending scene, I said this whole episode gets downhill after this. This is actually good. Because it did make me feel something. And that's very hard in a series like this. The Rudius's departure is really well done. Because he has grown to love these children as his own, but at that same time, he's seeing them grow into a young man and a young woman. And like he wants to stay with them, but he made, you know, a promise to them. It was only up until this point, so he's going to have to leave. And there's also that part of him that, yeah, he knows like the curse is dying around him, but he still doesn't want them to be afflicted by it in any way. And he's really truly become a father to them. Having hung out with them for this long, loved them for this long, looked after them for this long. So it's mutually hurtful on all sides, but it also makes sense for the story in that this is who he is. He did not agree to go anymore, and he's not the type of person to insist that he has to come. Maybe if they had begged a little more, he might have done it, but that would have been, in his eyes, bad because of them being acting like children. And he sees them as adults now. So they need to be on their own, doing their own thing. I get it. That is great. Then we get into, before that, we do have like the moment of Rudy seeing his house gone. Like, he knows where most of his family is at, minus his mother. So it's not like, oh no, everything's gone. And his mother is going to be a huge motivating factor for other things happening later on here. So that's fine. Then we get into the refugee camp outside of, we know, Eris's old home, the city. And you see the devastation, even 2 years after the events. Like, rebuilding has been done, but they're nowhere close to being back to where they were. That's how bad the Mana Cataclysm was. All the people who died as a result of it. People trying to rebuild from the ashes. And, oh no. people are people. Politickers are got a politicking, and they need someone to blame. And it was already that side of the Gray Rat family who didn't like Aerys's side, looked down upon them. So her grandfather, Zaros, you're out, buddy. An undignified death, but one that I feel bad because, despite his many flaws, he was still kind of an okay guy. He didn't deserve what he got. But I'm also not like, this is out of character for anyone. No, this is perfectly in character for the other side of the family to do because they're just that rotten to the core. And it also makes sense. People need someone to blame. Like, no one understands how this monocataclysm thing worked. You were in power. You should have done something about it. Because if they're looking at you instead of me, they're saying, well, you should have done something about it. So I'm going to put the blame on you instead. Also makes sense to me. An undignified end, but an end nonetheless. And I kind of like, because I'd forgotten his name, and it's revealed in the episode. Yeah, Alphonse. How blunt he is here. And I think that's a sign of him actually caring about Aerys. And how she feels. It's like, okay, this is what... I'm glad you're alive. I'm overwhelmed, but like... You got to know what the status quo is here, and you got to make some thinking really quickly about what you want to do, because there's some things you could do, other things you could do. Yeah, just think about this. And it's cruel, but it's cruel to be kind. And I can appreciate it when a character does that, because Aerys needs to know this information. She needs to make as well informed an opinion as she can on what she needs to do next. However, we'll get to her when we get to her. So it's nice to see Ghislaine again. Still not big on her design. As far as the revealing armor and stuff, you know, whatever. It's Mushoku Tensei. What else do you expect? So let's get back into the summary. So later that night, Aerys comes to Rudy's tent and asks to spend time with him. She says, you know, I'm all alone now. My family's gone. I just turned 15 the other day, and Rudy's kind of freaks out because like he wasn't keeping track of time. He apologizes for not remembering, which is rather sweet, and asks her what she'd like for a present. And she says that she wants a family. And she asks him to be a part of that. And she asks to sleep together. Now, Rudeus, to his initial credit, has the presence of mind to ask if he's taking advantage of her in a situation where she's emotionally, like, detached from reality to an extent, has gotten some of the worst news imaginable about her family being gone, and now she's, you know, seeking sex for solace. But she demands that he go along with it. She pushes him on the bed, lies on top of him, asking him if he likes her or not, and if he's been ogling her, which he agrees to, because we all know the truth. So she doesn't know why he's saying no, because she's in the midst of emotional despair. He's in the midst of being himself. It's all wrong. He says he wanted to wait until he turned 15, which was the promise. But then she talks about how her mother taught her something to say that she'll only be able to say once because it's that embarrassing. So in the callback no one asked for, she recalls his fetish for the beast races by telling him she wants him to have his kittens meow. Isn't that just riveting? Which breaks him into submission, and they have sex with each other. In the midst of this action, Rudeus reminisces on their time together, growing up with each other, his feelings for her. Nothing is shown on screen to the show's credit. This could have easily gone a higher route. We could have seen more of an underage girl, which I appreciate them restraining themselves. But he wakes up in the morning after, and in narration talks about how it's a wonderful morning and no one should be upset because now he's a normie. And he has plans with his girlfriend, who he goes to wake up but finds that Aerys is not there, insisting she must be embarrassed. He does everything he can to think of this in a way that doesn't go wrong. But then he finds her cut hair on the floor. He picks it up, and he also finds the dreaded Dear John letter, where she explains they're not well matched right now, so she's going away for a time. He goes to Alphonse and asks where she is. He explained that she's gone with Ghislaine to adventure rather than her becoming a concubine, and told him not to let them tell Rudeus exactly where they went. He can know they left, but not tell him exactly where they went. And this leaves Rudeus dejected and wondering, you know, why this is all happening. Is he didn't know? Did she dump me? Did she abandon me? Are we even family now? Did she just do this and leave? Ike cries and wanders off on his own. Let's start with Rudeus. I hate this episode. I hate this episode. I was so positive at the beginning because that's good. I'm so negative right here at the end because it sucks. You want to know why? Multiple factors here. It derails Eris's character, and it keeps Rudeus on the tracks. Well, what should happen is both of them get on the tracks together and understand where they're coming from, because, oh my gosh, we'll get to Eris in a moment. I think this is truly character assassination for her. But for Rudeus, this is exactly what I expect from him, and I'm still pissed off about it. Look at him. Need I remind you? Rudeus, mentally speaking, is a 45-ish year old man in the body of about a 13-year-old. Get that in your head. Now, were this to happen, were reincarnation to be real, which you've already talked to, I don't think it is, and you were able to retain memories of a past life, what's the game plan here? Well, a certain thing known as honesty. If he attempts, even, let's say it's okay for a moment. We'll give some of the people who love this series, we'll throw them a bone real quick. It's okay for them to have sex right now. Sure. Let's go with that premise. Even thinking that is right, you know what's wrong? Not being honest with someone you are sharing literally the most intimate thing you can do together. You should know who you're with. And you know what? I know some people out there saying, oh, this sounds really judgy. You know what it is? Because judgy is how you should go on this. There's a right way to have a relationship, and it's not this. There's a reason why marriage is the way. It should be someone you've spent time with, gotten to know intimately enough as a person, so then when you're later intimate, you stick together. Because you know who each other are. Yeah, there's always going to be things, bumps along the way after marriage. No marriage is ever perfect, blah, blah, blah. But if you start on a solid enough foundation, those things aren't going to matter as much. And what you've done here is you've created a very terrible foundation for this relationship to start on. Because you have not told her who you are. You've shown her that you can be a good person. I do think Rudeus can be a good person. He's done good things. Lowercase g. But it is inherently wrong to lie about who you are to the person you claim to love enough to get this far with them. And I hate that. Because Eris deserves to know. And spoilers, other women deserve to know, because this is that kind of series. And yet, it doesn't get brought up at any point that I can recall to these women that he ends up intimate with in this way. And that astounds me. I couldn't imagine hiding this from someone that I loved. How could you be so selfish? How could you be so self-centered? And yet, even if she doesn't believe you, that's one thing. Because it's a wild thing. It's literally another reality she has no context for. That's its own thing. But that's if you told her. Eris doesn't know because you refuse to tell. You refuse to bring up who you were because you're ashamed of yourself. And you know what? You should be ashamed of yourself. Because you're still him. Because you haven't grown as much as you think you have. And this is another reason why I hate Rudeus. Because he took advantage of someone who is in the midst of emotional turmoil, which is also a terrible way to start a relationship, especially a physical one. And he's one of the reasons why I want to take my hands around his throat and just snap his neck. So I can only imagine, you know, I don't have children, but if I did, someone did this to my daughter, didn't tell the truth of who they were, that's a dead man. And then took advantage of her in a moment like this, dead man. And it's scummy things like that that make him one of the worst characters in all of fiction. And I don't think I'm being provocative when I'm saying it. I don't think I'm being pedantic. I think I'm being truthful. Because that scumminess never leaves him. Never leaves him. Maybe somewhere down the road, I'm filling myself with false hope and he can be true about who he is and be, you know, less of an idiot about it all. Maybe. But I doubt it. This story has given me nothing to think that he's in the wrong for doing this because it doesn't think about that. Or if it does, it brushes it under the rug. And that's unacceptable. Because you can't start a relationship built on that. Relationships are supposed to be built on trust. And when you break trust with someone, you keep information away from them, you're not showing them that you love them. Yeah, we all have secrets. But to the person you love more than anything, that should be something you should be able to talk to them about, at least in some way, shape, or form. To admit when you did something stupid. To admit when you sinned in a bad way. Well, sin is bad to begin with, but you know what I mean. So that you can share your weaknesses with one another and prop each other up. That's the great thing about marriage. It's supposed to be a partnership, but you can't have a partnership if you don't trust the other person. If a husband can't trust his wife, if a wife can't trust her husband, what's that relationship built off of? Sand. And it's going to topple down because you haven't built a solid foundation there. And Rudeus is so in the wrong here. And there's someone else in the wrong here, too, because it takes two to tango. But I would argue more that's for character assassination purposes than it is for actually being something she would do. And let's move on to Eris then. Eris has spent 2 years getting to know Rudeus a little more than before when he was just her tutor, gaining an appreciation for him, learning to love him as a man despite reasons I can't imagine any woman would ever want that in her life, unless there was some very damaging things in her past that made her think that it was okay, which, as far as I know, Eris doesn't have that. And she looks at him as a hero. Because you know what? He's done heroic things. He's done things that had no direct reward for himself, and a true hero would do something like that. But she doesn't know him. And she thinks she does, but that's its own problem. We already talked about that. But Eris is not thinking rationally here. And some would argue that that makes everything that what happens next okay. I would say no, for multiple reasons. She's gotten some very, very bad news about her family. You know what? I would be upset if I had spent 2 years trying to track down my family only to learn my mom and dad are dead. You know, my grandfather got killed for politics, and I was about to be courted off to someone that I don't even know or love or respect. You know what? That's traumatizing. And that's the trauma she's already suffered. So her asking everyone to leave makes sense. Give her time alone to think. But she makes an irrational decision because the author wants her to make an irrational decision because he wants what happens to Rudeus later on in the series to happen. I believe it was Roger Ebert who said, if you have your characters acting in an idiot way, I'm paraphrasing in heavily here, just so you can make things happen, you have an idiot plot. This is an example of an idiot plot. The author needs Rudeus to be down in the dumps so that the events of next season can happen. versus what could have happened here, in that, let's even give him what he wants. They even have a sexual encounter here. And what Eris could have done is explain herself, not through a letter, but through talking. And yeah, that would have been painful. Yeah, that would, some would even argue that might be maturity beyond her age, which I might even grant you. But it would prevent her from having her character assassinated. I'd love that. It'd show a little bit of rationalism and the emotion behind everything she's doing. I can't stand that. Maybe I wouldn't feel as much, you know, if I didn't like her as the character, but I do. And I hate to see her like this, because it's obvious this is not something she would do. She is a little bullheaded. She can be a little impetuous, but she does legitimately love Rudeus, because she thinks she knows the totality of him, because that's all he's exposed. Terrible choice of words there to her. You know what I mean? So the fact that she would seek sex for solace makes sense to me. I'm not big on it, but I can see why she would logically and emotionally go down that path. And her, there's that moment of, honestly, like, you've been doing all these things, you've been checking me out, you've been ogling me. Don't you love me? Don't you like me? I've seen what you do. You're just doing that for the sake of doing it. And that's an honest question, because they both know the answer is he wants her. She wants him. But it's the forced nature I'm not really big on either. It's like she backs him into a corner. And this one I can get a little more behind, once again, because she is in mental and emotional anguish. I think I can let a little bit of that slide. But it's the morning after. Oh, sorry. I didn't even get the part of Rudeus being like, oh, I'm a normie now. I'm a real person. I'm a man now because I've had sex, which is such an outdated line of thinking that it boggles the mind that you think, oh, as soon as I have sex, then I'm a man. Says who? Says society? Society, even our society now has moved a little bit beyond that, thank God. Going back to Eris, her leaving him makes sense, because, and she'll reveal in the next episode, like, one of her motivations behind it. But you know what she didn't do? Explain that to the man she claims she loves. So that is why I call this character assassination, because she does love Rudeus. So she would have explained to him either in person, even if that meant the pain of telling him out loud and then leaving him behind, or in the letter. But she was as vague as possible, and that's what's going to cause the stupid things that happen in the next season to happen as far as Rudeus and sex. It's so stupid. This is an idiot plot. And I hate it. And once again, I don't want to hate this show. I don't want to hate characters when they do these things. I want to like them. I want to at least understand why they do certain things. I can't understand fully why Eris would do everything she does here. Some of the stuff, yeah, I've listed out why I could, but not everything, because it serves the writer's purpose of making things bad for Rudeus versus let me logically make my characters make these decisions. So maybe you can even have that story, but not like this. Like, do you think your readers, because this, once again, originally a web novel, are idiots? I hate it. And that's why it's one of the worst episodes in the show. But we're not done. We have one more episode left. I've already talked over an hour about the other two. So let's see how long it takes me to get through episode 23. That, of course, being Wake Up and Take a Step. We open to Eris waking up by Ghislaine at a fire at dawn. They're going to depart on an adventure together. Rudeus, meanwhile, is alone in this tent, despondent over losing her. People, you know, at the refugee camp, we see them kind of going about their daily lives, farming the land, trying to rebuild, make things go back to normal. We see Alphonse kind of in distress at what happened. He's left some food and drink for Rudeus, and Rudeus doesn't want to leave his bed behind because he's just in the grasp of depression. So our opening scene here, effective enough. This episode's kind of like in the midst of kind of showing where everyone else where they're at right now, in service of, hey, we're going to have another season later on. But just so you can remember where everyone's at, let's show them. And it serves its purpose well enough. So I don't have too much to say on it other than to say I think it does a good enough job for the opening scene. So let's just move on. So we flash back to Rudeus's time at school because we still don't know Rudeus's actual name. For some reason, I don't know why. Is it some reveal later on? I don't know. Maybe the author doesn't even care to give him a name. We see some bullies moving past of him and like the lunch line. They call him Udon, kind of a way of just calling him fat. With the Japanese cuisine mentioned there. And he calls him out for skipping in line because you should. And they, of course, because this is fictional media, then take him into the basketball court and kick basketballs into him, which, okay. Probably throw him and hurt him harder that way, but far be it to me to give advice to bullies, fictional evil Japanese bullies. And then a scene, we once again see the scene where he's laid out naked and hung up in front of his peers, an action that in any other media ever or in real life would have had severe repercussions for the people involved, unless like someone's dad was the prime minister or something, which they don't even give that justification in the show. So maybe you explain more in the light novel or the web novel, whatever. I don't know, man. I just work here. We didn't see him like in the midst of the beginnings of his, you know, hikikomori lifestyle, doesn't know, it's like the shut-in kind of lifestyle. He's lashing out at his parents who won't even enter his room because they're afraid for him and afraid for themselves. And like, you know, his dad tells him, look, you got to get back up. We can do this together. We're going to find the kids who did this to him. We're going to get to the administration. We're going to get them expelled, which is what would happen in, you know, an irrational, you know, moment. I'm not going to say the world is entirely rational, but most places where this would have happened, there would have been repercussions. But because we have to have bad things happen to Rudeus to justify him being a terrible person, then this happens. So whatever. His mother leaves him some food and a message to tell him, hey, don't give up. You know, we love you. And he just cries in solitude about his life. We didn't go back to the present, and we see Alphonse meeting with Rudeus. He sees that the food that he left for him earlier had gone bad. Tells him, hey, it's time you got out of bed. Look, I need help. If this will give you purpose, that'll make up for some of this. I got, like, wells that need to be dug, or we need people to move timber for housing. In regards to Eris, like, I'm going to tell you, look, I'm going to report that she died due to demonic cataclysm. Because anything else would hinder the reconstruction effort. And rebuilding Fatoa is his main concern right now because he can't do anything for her presently. And this is one way he can actually look out for her. And Rudeus says, well, I don't care about any of that. None of that's my concern. So, in a bit of, hey, tough love, Alphonse says, well, you're wasting space here just living in his tent. And you're not the only one suffering. So either move on and do something or just get out. Tough love, I agree. The Eris, meanwhile, still adventuring with Ghislaine, and Ruzhard is doing the same on his own. We kind of flash between the two during this moment in time. You know, Ruzhard saves some travelers to ask him his name. Eris talks about how smart, strong, and talented Rudeus is, and she wants to measure up to him, and that, you know, she wasn't afraid because, you know, he was with her. And Ruzhard admits to, like, the merchants that he saved that, you know, he's super, but instead of what he expects to happen, they embrace his true self when he shows his gem off to them. They're like super excited about it. They talk about all the bedtime stories we grew up with. Oh, my mom said if I didn't do my chores or I didn't eat my broccoli or whatever, like the superb would eat me. And like, we're just kind of like, yeah, you know, it sounds about right. It's like, I don't eat children. And they kind of laugh about it. It's a pretty good moment. You see, like, the curse is like starting to break. A good moment in this episode. We go back over to Eris, and she's talking to Ghislaine about how she, you know, she never thought that Rudeus would die. She had, like, this high opinion of him. I thought he was better than her. But when he almost did, she was afraid. And she knew that one of the reasons why he almost died is because she wasn't strong enough. And she hated her weakness. And logically, we all know, like, there's nothing she could have done. Like, she'd been training, and there was nothing that could have prepared her for that. But in the midst of her emotional woe, she thinks that she wasn't good enough, that she could have done better, because that is something Eris would do. And we go over to Ruger, and he asks, like, hey, you guys afraid of me? I'm like, no, they can't bring themselves to do that, you know, because, you know, he saved their lives. And, you know, that's pretty good. Then we go over to Eris, saying that, you know, she loves Rudeus. She'll go to see him again after she trains to defeat the dragon gods so that she can protect them. So we actually learn part of her motivation here that would have been really good in the last episode if she had told Rudeus these things. You know, because she loves him, allegedly, according to the author. And I do think she does. I just think she got character assassinated. Sue me. All right, so for our three main characters of this part of the season, let's go with Rudeus. Based on the information he has available to him, this makes sense. I think it's stupid. I think it's not what he deserves, even though Rudeus is Rudeus. But because the author decided to do what he decided to do, it makes sense for Rudeus to be as down in the dumps as possible here, because he has had literally the most intimate thing you can experience with another person, with the person that he loves. Which means she's also sharing love with two other people, but, you know, Rudeus being Rudeus, he ruins everything. But then that person leaves you, doesn't even have the dignity to, like, explain in person why she's doing what she's doing. She leaves you that Dear John letter, and your life is upended because, well, you know where most of your family is. You don't know where your mom is. And you thought that you and Eris wouldn't, like, break up. Why would you break up the Scooby Gang? Like, it makes no sense. Ruger's gone too. That one makes more sense because he'd agree to do one thing and he fulfilled his promise. But Eris doesn't make sense to him because they had this moment together. They got what they both wanted. And she didn't leave? Did she ever love him, really? Did she just do it because she felt bad for him? Like, he doesn't know because she doesn't explain herself. But she can't explain herself to Ghislaine. We'll get to that in a moment. So let's go to Ruger. I mean, out of everyone involved, everything's looking up Ruger today. And that's good. Because you have the idea, we are told that the curse is breaking. But we are actually shown in this episode how that is happening. People's perceptions of the Superb remain because they grew up with it. It's not like it got retconned out of existence. But when rational people see a Superb in person, see that he saved their lives and he's not some wild demon just out on the run to murder them, well, there's less of a reason for them to make assumptions. Is he just trying to save us so that he can eat us himself or kill us himself? No. Maybe that would have happened with the curse still active. But since the curse isn't active, maybe one of the things the curse did was it created those moments in people's minds where they would go, oh, they would create something to rationalize. Maybe Ruger would probably save thousands, millions of people's lives in 400 years while he was gone. But there was probably always something from the curse that made them rationalize some way of saying, oh, he did this because of X, Y, Z, because he's evil. But now with the curse weakening, that doesn't happen as often, or maybe at all. Maybe that's me writing too much into the story, but I think I'm reading that correctly. And that's great. Wonderful moment there for him. Then we get to Eris. And I was almost, when I was watching this for the first time, I was convinced the author wanted me to hate Eris forever. Because this is not how you write someone that you want to pull for. She explains what she thinks of Rudeus. Smart, strong, capable, loyal, great guy, someone she wants to be with. But she didn't tell him that. Nor did she tell him the reason, one of the primary reasons she left is that she doesn't feel good enough. She always compares herself to him. And this has been something that's been throughout the show. But you would think, if you were going on this path, you would say something. Like, she doesn't have to give every detail. She doesn't have to list her 50-step plan to Rudeus. Like, say, hey, it's not you. I love you. I'm not strong enough. I don't think I'm good enough. So I'm going to make myself good enough. And the next time we see each other, you're going to know that I'm going to protect you because I failed to do that. And that hurts me. Simple conversation. And yes, once again, teenagers, not the smartest in the world. One of them's 45 mentally, but you know, that's its own thing. But something other than what happened. Like, you can't contrive another way for this to go. Like, if I didn't know some of the events to happen later on, I think I would hate Eris now as a character. But I think more I hate the author for making her this way than I do her, because this just isn't her. It's illogical. Now, the reasons she gives are good, but why she did what she did and not explaining herself isn't her. Because I can see herself saying, I should have defended him better. I should have been better. I should have saved Rudy. He never should have died. He never should have been donutted. He'd go full Cacuon. But we end up with what we end up. And I think that says a lot about a writer and his perception of women. That aren't positive, shall we say? I don't know. Maybe I'm reading too much into that. But because he does write compelling women at times. But when they're brought into the black hole that is Rudeus, they start to lose their true character. And that really irks me. Because I think these ladies deserve a little better. I think they're smarter than who he makes them to be, but whatever. Let's move on to the next section. We didn't see, like, you know, two soldiers in a carriage, like, escorting Zenoba. He wants to go find his master as he's, like, marveling over the Roxy figurine. He says he'll find him again, setting up for the next season. Geese, meanwhile, is kind of traveling through the desert, wishing, you know, Boss Rudeus was there to make him water for him. That's a pretty funny scene. It's like, I kind of talked about the logistics of that. Oh, yeah, it'd be great to have a mage who could just literally make water whenever, and you're in the middle of the desert. Like, no. You could fill up the canteens whenever you wanted. Makes perfect sense to me. We then go over to the little dog beast race village and the cat one too, where we see like it's kind of thriving in Rudeus's absence after what he helped them out with. The children are training. We see the cute little dolls that they had made of them. We go see some of the demons that they made friends with, you know, reach the ocean as they're exploring together, and they're asked by someone else, hey, is it true that you met Dead End? There we go. You know, in the past, Rudeus overhears some neighbors and like the apartment above or below where his parents live or something like that. And they're talking about him. They think in hushed tones, but he can literally hear everything because apparently the Japanese ability to, I don't know what's the word is looking for here, soundproof. Yeah, their apartments is abysmal. And there's this little girl who like wants to, you know, help him out. Like, she's super sweet, but her parents are like, oh, I don't know about that. He'll figure it out. So he kind of gets a sense of, well, that's what everyone kind of thinks of me. And we didn't go over to the demon continent in the present, where Roxy and her friends are getting drunk together. And one of them is Kishirika, the inappropriately dressed demon lord who's, you know, 1,000 years old or whatever, but she still looks like a child because we have to use that trope. They are drunk. The next day, Roxy wakes up. Kishirika can't pay for her drinks because she's broke. They've gone full. Never mind then. And she's about to be sold into slavery for not being able to do so, but Roxy intervenes, being the kind woman that she is, pays for them herself. And in gratitude, Kishirika reveals that she is the demon empress and that she can tell her where Rudeus can be found. We didn't see her looking at his family because one of the things that Roxy asked, okay, well, show me where all of Rudeus's family, show me where they're at. And that impresses Kishirika because she used a selfless wish. And so she gives a little more than she asked for. We see Paul being reunited with Aisha and Lilia. And he swears to Norn that, you know, Rudeus will find Zenith. And if not, he will. Kishirika then shows Zenith in danger underground. But there's something about the location that she's in, like messing with her vision. But she gives Roxy the approximate location of her being in the Beggarit continent in the labyrinth city of Rapan. Kishirika then lives, after showing her where Rudeus is, leaves Roxy behind and informs the others of Zenith's location, saying she must be in some trouble. Otherwise, she would have said something, so something would have happened. Zenith being who she is, she was a former adventurer, she would have been able to get herself out of most anything, so something bad had to have happened. Alina Lise asks, you know, are you worried about Rudeus? But Roxy says, you know, Rudeus will get back up on his own. She has faith in him. We go back to a flashback where Rudeus in his old body is, you know, even more depressed, you know, nothing bringing him satisfaction. You know, he kind of says, you know, people are reaching out to me, but I'm rejecting them. I'm too stuck in my own paranoia, just thinking that they're all laughing at me, to even love them back, which would almost be a case for him, like, realizing himself. And yet we know the end story there. He doesn't learn anything because he's Rudeus. And we flash forward to the present. He thinks that no one will do the same now. He just thinks they're all laughing at him. But then we get this nice little moment of a flashback of Zenith watching him and Paul fight, you know, when they're training each other, and them just being a family together when they come back inside. And he sees she looks kind of, you know, upset, down. He's like, okay, hey, Mom, go get some rest and you go do so. You can, I'll take care of everything because I can take care of myself. And then he orders Paul to do it instead for the sake of his wife. No, rather than him actually doing something, it was pretty funny. Zenith thanks Rudeus, and he says, you know, it does because they're family. And she tells him that she loves him. And we go back to the present, and we see this kind of breaks him out of his funk. Because he realizes, yeah, all these bad things are happening, but I got to find my mom. Which gives him renewed purpose, and he leaves the refugee camp behind to do so. And then after the credits, we have an end scene where Rudeus is being recommended by an unknown person. Let's call this unknown person, you know, Quattro Bagina, or perhaps Cinco Venus, if that's more your mileage there. And they recommend that Rudeus to the group in attendance. We don't know who they are. I know who they are because I watched the other season. But without spoiling things, we'll get there when we get there. And this person has told them, everything that Rudeus has done, they don't really kind of believe in, like, incantations of magic when he was like 5. What are you talking about? That's weird. But you're the one saying it, so, I mean, we guess we respect you. And there we go. That is the end of season 1. We have finally got there. So, my thoughts. Rudeus's backstory. I said my snarky little comments the whole time I was in the midst of it, because I believe in those snarky comments. Bullying in school, I think I talked about this on another episode, but it's been over a year, so I don't know, man. I'm not going to say bullying never happened when I was in school. And I was in public school for elementary and high school. I was homeschooled for middle school. Precisely because my dad knew how bad the middle school was. So maybe I would have experienced more of it there. So I will throw that caveat out there. The worst I can remember ever being, quote unquote, bullied in school is when I got my glasses for the first time. And one of the other girls in my class called me Four Eyes. And I was kind of like, okay. And then I moved on with my life. And that's weird. And later on, she got glasses and I didn't say anything back. Not because I was trying to be the better person, because I didn't care. And yeah, there were some people in high school, there were some outcasts. I know other people didn't treat them as well, but I was one of those weird people. I was kind of like friends with almost everyone. So I didn't really have like a clique or a specific group I was with. My best friends were a cheerleader and a basketball player and an army nut. But I could hang with pretty much almost anyone, except for like the excessive, you know, stoner losers. Or I'm trying to think if there was one other group I didn't mesh well with. I mean, pretty much every other group I can think of, and you know, the unaffiliated, the unincluded, you know, go American Dad there, I was fine with and friendly with, if not friends with. So I say all that because the Hollywood and Stephen King and anime side of bullying doesn't make logical sense to me. I know it's happened in the world. I know there are terrible kids out there who have done terrible things to fellow students because of problems at home, or because they wanted to feel superior, because they wanted to feel involved with the group. I know they exist. I know there are some administrations out there, as far as school administrations, who haven't done their due diligence to solve some of these problems. But when we get to Rudeus's backstory, okay, you know what? There might be someone out there who wouldn't believe the kicking basketballs in his face thing happened. And this would be at a time where cameras weren't as common as they used to be. So maybe there wasn't a camera in a gym, which is a huge security risk, but whatever. Let's go with that. Let's say that's real. But then, like, we don't show the fullness because they're showing the full flashback earlier on of him being tied up, essentially almost crucified, really, completely naked, and it being filmed with students' voices being heard, laughing at him and all this. And you're telling me no one did anything about this? I call bull. Complete and utter bull. That takes me out of the story immensely. Maybe you guys can give me a case where something like this happened and nobody got punished in the real world. I could believe something like that happened, but like, this is just over the top for the sake of being over the top to make you feel, oh, he really had it bad. Oh, isn't Rudeus a tragic figure? Isn't it okay that he's a little messed up? It's like, no, this justifies nothing. Because he's completely and utterly ungrateful. He's been given, you see his parents aren't jerks to him. They love him. Now, would it have been better for them to actually, you know, talk to him and bring him to a therapist? But is this, when this is made, is it still the early 2000s? That's something that's not, you know, really talked about a lot, still frowned upon? Sure, whatever. I can give you a little leeway there, but like, they just give up on him? No way. Not the parents that I see in the flashbacks. That doesn't justify him being who he is at that then present and then the actual present. It's stupid. It's awful. And I would feel better about his realization at the end that his mother Zenith in this world is still missing. And that's what motivates him to go. I'd feel better about that if we had some way of justifying who he was before. Maybe he had a terrible mother. If his mother had been like yelling at him, it was like some kind of harpy, just like, get over it. Get out of this house. We don't want you. Yeah, it would have been maybe over the top, but it would make him like have reasons to not love her and miss her as much as he does for Zenith. But I do like that what motivates Rudeus to get back up on his feet, to go out into the world and challenge himself again, is that his mother is missing. Because there is something loving about that, something actually wonderful about that. And it does set up for the next season fairly well. It's just infuriating because I want better for this show. And I know where some things go later on, and it's, yeah. So let's just move to the ending scene. Let's kind of talk about the season as a whole after that. We've gone long enough, might as well keep going. This is an effective enough setup as someone who was an anime only, or still is an anime only, and the fact that I hadn't seen a season two yet. This group of characters, you don't know who they are, except for the extremely obvious one. If you were fooled by this, I don't know what I can do for you. And the fact that Rudeus is fooled by it later on, as someone as supposedly intelligent as he is, whatever. Okay, are you ready? You want to avoid spoilers? All right, 3, 2, 1. It's Sylphie. It's Sylphie. Sylphie is right there. Monocataclysm sent Sylphie her all the way there to where this nuke location is going to be. It's going to be a Hogwarts kind of setting, which is super cool because I kind of like how it's designed to an extent. And it's going to lead to the degradation of her character, too. And that's what really pisses me off. But right now, you know, Cinco Venus over here, if you don't know what that is, it's a playoff of the Quattro Vagina thing, which is itself a Gundam thing. Mobile Suit Zeta Gundam. I'm fairly certain this is an intentional reference by the author. It'd be really hard to see how it wasn't. Quattro Vagina is actually a character known as Char Aznable. Spoilers for a show that came out, you know, almost 50 years ago, almost. And, well, it'd be more like 40 years for Zeta. Yeah. And it's such a super obvious disguise for a character that we knew in the original Mobile Suit Gundam. That's like, how did anyone get fooled by this? And it kind of goes to the point where it's almost like For those of you who've read the original, like, Strange Tales, where Johnny Storm, the Human Torch, was the main character for a while, because Stan was trying to hit for the hip, you know, teenage audience at the time, teenagers, as it were. And he tried to have a secret identity in this town that he was going to with his sister, who was publicly known as the Invisible Girl at the time. She was the Invisible Girl, and he was publicly known as the Human Torch. And it's kind of like, why would you do that? And it's kind of revealed at the end, oh, we just wanted to respect your privacy. We all knew you were a Human Torch. Even though that wasn't the obvious intent from the beginning. Yeah. It's one of those obvious reveals. And I'm not knocking that. Because I kind of like what they do with Sylphie to an extent in what's happening next. So it's good to see her again in the normal status quo, because this would have been in between, like the end of the season would have been setting up for layers, you know, oh, he's probably going to meet Sylphie. So spoilers over there. Let's talk about the season in review. I don't like this show. I know that is absolutely shocking to everyone listening right now, whether you're doing it on YouTube, whether you're doing it, you know, on your phone or whatever. Because I've said it before, I'll say it again. You're probably tired of me hearing it. This is one of the best examples I can think of. Missed potential. There is so much potential in this series. The world building is spectacular. Like, you have heard me praise that over and over again. The different countries we go to, different races that exist in the world, the different politics that involve these different countries and stuff like that, the family rivalries and stuff like that. Yes, yes, give me some of that. But that's not enough. You've got to make me care about these characters you're telling a story around. And some of them, yes, I'm there. Ruzhard, my boy. Love him. There's only one thing I know about his later character that is not in a season that has aired yet that I'm super not big on. It's because I know the author, and the author thought it was a good idea. Guessing about his character, you can probably guess what happens later on. But like the whole thing with the Superd and, you know, the curse upon them. And like I said, I'd forgotten about the thing with the man god explaining this stuff to Rudeus about how he'd actually changed him. Like, that's a good example even for Rudeus. Like, you saw someone in need, you did something about it, you tried to change people's perception of them, and it worked. And it wasn't like, we just handed this to you. No, you actually did something about it. You thought this through tactically. That is good. Good on you, writer, for making this. Good on you, character Rudeus, for making it happen. Because other people wouldn't have done it, but you did. You saw an outcast as someone who was an outcast, and you did something about it. Good. You go, what happens with Eris at the end here? She was such a strong character. And yeah, there were still parts of her that like accepted Rudeus's perviness and molestation too much for my own ends. But I also know who I'm working with as an author here. So like, I don't like let them slide, but I get it. Only to derail her at the end of this season. Hate it. Hate it completely. And then Rudeus. Rudeus ruins everything. You know why? Because he sucks. You know why? Because he is untapped potential to its fullest extent. Why doesn't he grow? Well, Rudeus grows. Do not get me wrong. He is not a static character. He is not a flat character. Rudeus has depth to him. But he undermines it every single step of the way, and I am sick and tired of it, and it does not end. Because believe it or not, he can get worse. And if we do get there, we'll get there. Because I intend to get there. Before I get myself even angrier, like, once again, I want to say, if you love this series, I don't hate you. I don't think you're stupid. I don't think you have bad taste. I just think we have a difference of agreement in how things should be. And if you know you're one of those people, it's like, hey, let me explain why I like it. Leave a comment down below. I'd love to see what you have to say, and I'll do my best to respond to it. I just want better for this, and it irks me. And we've got a whole other season to get to, and maybe we'll get through it all before the third season happens, because I would like to get to a different set of genres and media, and not just stick to anime, because like I mentioned forever ago, there are other things that I don't like. Oh, man. We'll get there. We'll get there as I hit my microphone. That's great. Near the end here. So, scores for the final three episodes of season one, part two, 18 A-. You nailed it. You got it. Great setup for a potential villain or just potential figure in a story. Love Worsted. Love Rudy is having to deal with the man got there. Episode 22, F-. You know why. Everything I said before and more. Episode 23, B+. Effective enough as an ending. It does leave me captivated enough to continue on, as I did. Not just because Mama didn't raise no quitter, but because I wanted to keep going. That was, I was filled with hope. False hope, I'll find out. But I was filled with hope that maybe things will turn around. So that's it. We've completed season one of Mushoku Tensei. I do plan, I stress plan, to get to season two along the way. Thank you, everyone, for listening. Please get a chance to leave a 5-star review on your podcasting platform of choice. If you're listening to this on YouTube, like the video, comment below, subscribe to Systematic Ecology or Anazam Mysteries on their pages. You can email me at whyidontlikepodcasts@gmail.com. If you're interested in my own fiction writing and you want to criticize me, you can find my works at starvingwritersguild.com or on Amazon if you search for the name MC Ashley. You can also say words. That'd be nice. You can also find me podcasting. With all that in mind, I spent a lot of time discussing what I don't like about Mushoku Tensei. But you know what I do like? You listeners. I like you. So see ya, Space Cowboy.